Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and no Christine today. Explain that in a minute, but our guest this week from the Queenstown Sampler Designs is Barbara Hudson. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Gary. Good to see you. Well, I hear you tonight.
Right. Last time we were together, we saw each other at the Nashville Market, so.
Yeah, that was a good time. Really good time.
Yeah, that's a great show. Looking forward to that next year. Yes. So we're gonna talk reproduction samplers tonight, but Christine not with us, and it gets confusing if you're following, because we record the Sunday shows with our guests. We record ahead of time. So by the time this one airs, it's quite likely that Christine will be well. The shows that we do on Wednesday, we do the week of, and oftentimes we do them on Wednesday. So that keeps us current, but these we do ahead of time, and we're doing this one on March 27. And Christine, if you followed, had been in a car accident last week and has a concussion, and it's not getting better. And I got text from her this afternoon that she went to the doctor and he shut her down completely. She's to do nothing for the next 2 or 3 weeks. So hopefully by the time that you hear this, which will be in a couple of weeks, she will be well. But this is not getting better, and so the doctor has just completely shut her down. So she's not with us tonight, and we'll see how it goes. But as I've said in previous podcasts, if prayer is part of your life, Christine needs them. She's I think she got banged pretty good there. She's not doing well. So we'll count on her to heal soon, quickly. But anyway, we're going to forge on. So we have Barbara Hudson, Queenstown Sampler Designs. And where does the Queenstown come from?
Well, I live in Queenstown, Maryland, so I thought that was a pretty good name for my company. So.
Well, that's just flat out creative. That must have been a long meeting, huh?
Well, yeah, that was a long meeting. I also live on Wynot Road, Wyeknot, on a little trickling of the Y River, Wye, named after the same river once. So the people that came over back in the 1630s came to that area where the Y River in England was. Yeah, they weren't very creative naming their rivers around here. So it's the same.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I love your part of the country because of the history. And we were talking before we started recording here about how I'd mentioned before my family got here from England because the British had hauled orphan boys over to fight in the Revolutionary War. And a couple of Parr brothers got brought over, and after the war, stayed, and that was the beginning of our family in the U.S. And then you have an interesting story with the fact that your name is spelled with a T.
Yes, my husband's family, Hudson, used to spell it with a D, H-U-D-S-O-N, but in the 1840s, they changed it to a T because they were not happy with the Whig Party at the time. The family was living in Iowa. They had some big farms there and just outside of Devonport. And they were not happy, the Whigs. And so they changed it to a T. And thereafter, the part of the family that my husband came down directly from was spelled with T. But we do have he does have cousins that spell it with the letter D. They live in Idaho somewhere. But yeah, fun tracing it. I have a sampler, Emily Hudson, that is not, I'm sure somewhere down the line she's related to us. There's quite a few Hudsons in the world, but I haven't been able to trace her exactly to our family, so. Someday I'll reproduce her. She's a very sweet little thing.
And yeah, there we go. That a political move there. That showed him.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, and that was the last time the Whigs and the Tories were around. One of the parties became Republican. I think, I forget now my history. Sorry.
Yeah. I forget too. I forget because I forget, and I forget intentionally at times too. Just I got more important things to worry about, you know.
But it's amazing what you can find when you're looking for your family, when you're looking for these sampler makers or any kind of ancestry you're doing. It's sometimes you find out some very interesting things.
Yeah, I got to believe that when you're doing these reproduction samplers and looking up the history, that it has to be, I mean, I always describe it for me as an editor, if I have to look in the dictionary for a word, it's never just look up the word and move on. It's, you know, a half hour later, I've been reading the dictionary and learning new words and definitions and so on. That's got to be like that when you look up sampler history, where you just start out and it just doesn't end till you end it.
No, it doesn't end. Yeah, I could be researching for hours and I'll look up and all of a sudden it's, you know, 3 o'clock and we never had lunch and my husband and poor baby, he needs his, you know. So, come on, is it time for lunch yet? Yeah, okay, if I have to. But yeah, I can spend hours and hours. And then we get sidetracked and my husband calls those butterflies and I go off on another end and I find things about other girls that I'm, you know, it's a good time is what it is.
Yeah.
So my friend, I call her my library goddess. She says I'm a closet librarian. So I have a good time researching.
There we go. So when you do this research, is it just Google searches or do you have some favorite starting points, some websites or something that give you a favorite starting point? Or do you use family lineage software services? What's your starting point?
Well, my starting point, usually I do go directly to familysearch.org, which is the Church of the Latter-day Saints, in conjunction with ancestry.com. And then my local library, too. I don't pay the big buck for the ancestry.com, but my library goddess does. Thank goodness. Because if I can't find something, she will. In fact, I'll decide. This my friend Cindy Steinhoff is the library director at a local college in Campbell County, and she can get into databases that I cannot. So I get so far with my research, and if I can't go any further, I hand it off to her, and then she just, you know, takes her minutes to find some things sometimes. So we've got Family Search, we've got Ancestry.com, and then it does help to do a Google search, and not just Google. I go to Bing because they have different ways of looking for things, different setups. So sometimes I'll find something on one that I won't find on another. Oh. And there's a third one. There's a third one I use too. And now please, it's actually called Dogpile, Dogpile.
No, yeah, kidding. I've heard of that. Sure. Yeah.
And it comes up with some weird things too. So I do at least two searches on just the possibly the girl's name, a date, an idea. If I don't have her age on the sampler, I guess her age to be around between 8 and 15. So I can, you know, and a lot of times, I might be getting ahead of myself, but I can usually, if it's a typical sampler, and I hate to say typical because there's so many kinds of samplers, but if I can identify a motif, or I can identify a school, or I can identify a certain area of the country, or different countries too, if it's American, I have a better chance of finding her, or English. That's just because I don't speak other languages very well, but I have friends in other countries that do help me out, like in Germany and the Netherlands and whatnot. And Google Translate is pretty good, but not always great. Let's see, what other sites?
Well, your librarian friend, you must be a godsend to your librarian friend. She can use all of her skills.
Oh, yes, she does. Yes, she does. She's been busy editing that the Delaware book that's coming out that we'll get to later. She's she truly is a goddess when it comes to anything, any research. So, and she's helped me a lot of ways too. Your library. My library has an Ancestry.com, a membership. And I can do some things through my computer while I'm at home through my library. But because of, not copyright, but because of terms of membership, I actually have to go to my library to look up certain things in Ancestry.com through my library in order to get certain information. And libraries around the country will have that service also. So it helps. It's a really good idea to go to your library and talk to your librarians about researching your genealogy or your sampler maker or whoever you're looking for. They're very good and very helpful.
Yeah, and that speaks to, I saw something the other day about someone who had asked the question about how valid libraries are anymore so many people use, you know, books on tape or whatever. And you just described there's a service that your tax dollars at work, you're able to get something mm-hmm. that you'd otherwise have to pay significantly for. And plus, librarians, the skills librarians have looking things up, none of the rest of us have those. So,
no, I love my library.
Yeah, yeah, and what we forget that we forget because we have a library. You know, everybody has a library somewhere, and we have one. We drive by it frequently. And you see on the sign upcoming events, and there's always two or three events, and usually the majority of them have to do with computers or the internet. And you if you stop and think, well, you know, there's a resource that matches what we do today, and it's in your library. And I know our library has been, for the most part, completely configured. They've cut way back on the number of bookshelves they have because they needed more room for computers and work desks and those kinds of things for these kinds of activities. And it's just a changing thing along with all the rest of us getting changed by the internet and by computers, and libraries have changed along with it. And as a result, they're still an excellent resource, just a different kind of resource. Yeah.
And I'll say this too. Even though I may look up my sampler makers and other things ahead of time while I'm reproducing a sampler, up until just before I go to print, I will do more research on my bill because you never know when something new might pop up. So I'm always looking for more information on my girls. Someday I'm going to find a sampler that's done by a young boy that I can afford, but usually those, anymore, they're going for a lot of money.
There are samplers boys, done by boys?
Oh, yes, by young boys. Whether it was, think of it this way. They might have been convalescing and not doing the normal things young boys do, or they might have, I taught my son how to stitch at a young age, and he enjoyed it. We did it as an art project, and he was very much into painting and art and whatnot. But yeah, all of my children I taught early. It didn't always catch on with all of them, or they went in a different direction, a different kind of craft or something.
Mm-hmm.
They all knew how to sew on a button, a zipper, and use a sewing machine. And in fact, I need to tell you this too. When I first met my husband, he had his own sewing machine.
There we go.
Yep. It had to be love. It had to be love at first sight. But his mother was a home economics teacher too.
Oh. Yeah.
So she made sure all her boys, and she had three of them, knew how to do that, and her daughter too. So
Yeah, you wouldn't get out of that house without knowing how to boil water and sew a button on. I'm sure of that.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So you obviously you've been stitching a long time then. How do you get started? You learn from your mother or?
Well, my mother was pretty busy. There were five of us children, and she actually went back to she went back to work when my youngest sister was a year old, and this was like 1959, and she went back to work. And so my dad worked second shift, so that kind of worked out. And my grandmother was living with us, so my grandmother taught me how to embroider. Freestyle type of embroidery stitches, real simple when I was about five, maybe, but I didn't really get good at it until I was maybe 10 years after that. Cause I've seen some of my early work in it. Nothing to brag about, but, I still have a handkerchief that, I had to write my name in cursive. And then I had to use a stem stitch and outline the whole thing. Oh. And then my grandmother did a nice little crochet attachment around the little handkerchief. So I have that, and I thought maybe 6 years old, but more like seven probably. But she taught me how to crochet, how to do embroidery. So I was doing a lot of embroidery in the, 60s and 70s on my clothes. And, I took a lot of classes in, high school on, spring, and, made a lot of, all my girls' prom dresses and some wedding gowns and things like that. So yeah, I've been stitching a long time. And every time I've tried to find during the 70s, there were all kinds of different, crafts, things I did with the children. And so I would try different things, but I always wanted to go back to stitching. I always wanted to, I was happiest when I was doing any kind of embroidery, whether it be on our clothes or on practical things. My grandmother always said there had to be something practical. You have to be able to use it. But then she was from a different generation too. But she made some very beautiful crocheted lace tablecloths and other embroideries. So my mother did know how to sew, but she was a busy woman. You know, with five kids and going back to work very early on, and so she didn't have a whole lot of time for that.
Yeah.
Later on, when I was junior high and then in high school and then a little bit in college, she and I got more into embroidery, doing different things. And there wasn't a whole lot of available where we were at in the Cleveland area, just outside of Cleveland. And it really didn't become all that more popular. So, my husband is retired military. So, we did move around a little bit, not as much as some military families, but, we finally, transferred to the DC area, and that's when I became more aware of different historical embroideries and samplers. A little bit before we left, let's see, I want to say 1982, I was working at junior high at that time, just as a monitor type person. I was office personnel. I was in charge of office detentions.
Oh, that, yeah, okay.
You didn't want to cross Mrs. Hudson. She didn't give out 15-minute detentions. They were an hour. But anyway, so a music teacher came in on her break time with this cute, adorable, what we would call a Pennsylvania, some people call it Pennsylvania Dutch, which is not correct. It's Pennsylvania German sampler kit that she was working on Ada cloth, and it was adorable. And she bought it at Lee Ward's. I don't know. I think maybe you might remember Lee Ward's.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's where when I got married, there was a Lee Ward's just down the road, and a lot of my early needlepoint kits and others, Dimensions kits and stuff. Oh, I spent a lot of hours walking up and down those aisles, you bet.
Oh, they were loaded with all kinds of things. Yeah. Yes, but they, but it wasn't now today considered quality threads and fabric. It was the only game in town. There wasn't much else there.
Right.
And that's when I got the bug again to do more embroidery and trying to find linen that my grandmother taught me how to work on was difficult because you had a few. You were in the Chicago area. You had Marshall Fields. You probably could go into the fabric departments of some of these nicer department stores at the time to find some linens, but it was more for suits and clothing than it was for embroidery. It was difficult to find embroidery fabric at that time. But anyway, I went off on a tangent to where were we? Oh yeah, the cute, adorable little sampler with a little Pennsylvania couple with little flowers in their hand facing each other, and then there were little compartments around. It was adorable. I ran off to Lee Ward's and I got myself my own kit, and I proceeded to make. And I had such a good time with this, and then I made two more, one for my mother-in-law and one for my sister for Christmas. And I said, but I didn't like working on the 8 o'clock so much because it was so stiff. And yes, this was cross stitch, but it wasn't. Exactly. You know, I prefer doing, at the time, freestyle surface, not surface embroidery. I didn't learn raised embroidery until a couple years after that. But, the cute little sampler, I have kept it so I would stay humble. I have it hanging up in my guest room.
Yeah.
In fact, I came across another one. There had to have been hundreds of those made. I found one in an antique store a couple of years ago locally, and someone had $20 on it. So that's what someone thinks it's worth. I think it's worth a lot more than that because it got me going into samplers again. And once we moved to the Washington, D.C. area, Annapolis area, I became more involved with going to the to talks at the DAR, at the Walters Art Gallery, Baltimore Museum of Art, Maryland Historical Society. And samplers at that point just kind of took over my life. I was introduced to Gloria Seaman Allen. At the time, she was the DAR museum curator. She was giving talks, and she and I both looked at each other and after her talks, and she had a list of maybe 13 known Maryland teachers of needlework, and we had maybe a couple dozen samplers we knew about that were made in Maryland. And this was the mid-90s, the first time we were talking about that. And we met up in Annapolis at one of the historical homes because they invited us to come see their quilt samples and their samplers. And she said, we're walking down a cobblestone street down in Annapolis one beautiful October afternoon, and after seeing these gorgeous Baltimore quilts, Baltimore album quilts and the samplers. And she said, Barb, why don't you write a book? I says, well, I'm not a woman of words. I said, I'd rather stitch my words. And and so I said, I think you should write the book, because she had written a couple of books already, one on Maryland quilts and then one on genealogical samplers in the DAR collection. And so I said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll start. And 10 years later, we had a huge list. And that's when her book came out in 2007. And we had she had one of the best sampler exhibits at the Maryland Historical Society, just a fabulous exhibit she put on, and it's always been a great joy to work with her and learn so much about the sampler teachers and makers in the great state of Maryland. So we continued on with that, and we did the book for the Washington, D.C. area, which encompassed Maryland again, but also Virginia and then D.C. There were some Navy Yard School. I'll get it all mixed up here, but that they produced quite a few wonderful samplers there, and so many other great schools. And the book that we've been working on for the last few years is the Delaware Sampler book, which is due to be published this year. So there's an exhibit coming up in June at the Biggs Museum of Art in Dover, where there's going to be a symposium on the 9th of June. And there's some big name lecturers going to be there. Mary Brooks from the Westtown Quaker School, and Anderson of the Sampler Archive. My library goddess, Cindy, will be speaking. There's a couple others. Get who now, but it's going to be a great day, and people can go to the Biggs Museum website to find out more about that if they'd like to be part of that. Come and see that, because it's relatively inexpensive. We were trying to get it down as low as possible, and trying to get a foundation to help pay for it, and we did find, and they did find a couple foundations to help pay for it, but It's a good deal. With lunch, it's $45 all day long. Oh. So I think that's pretty good e-ticket.
So you see, that's the thing where you live that I think people in general in the rest of the country don't really understand is folks on the East Coast in general, but certainly in the New England and Northeast there on the Atlantic seaboard, the history. The early American history is right there. You know, it's part of the fabric of your life, because that's the thing I love about Boston is, and I kill to get to Boston every chance I can, because, you know, one building will be this early American ancient thing, and right next to it, steel and glass. You know, mm-hmm. and the history is just right there all the time, and people have such a respect for it and such a desire to keep it alive and keep the awareness alive, that it just, I don't see that anywhere else in the country, certainly not in the Midwest. I mean, there's, you know, obviously an appreciation for the history, but you guys live it all the time. And when you talk about it, Daughters of the American Revolution, you know, that's, I mean, that's a very real thing where you, on the East Coast there, and, it's just so neat, and then when you're able to bring in samplers and the history of samplers, and talk about the girls that were stitching them in America, it's just I just love it. I just think it's just great stuff, and it's great that it is staying alive today, and that you're able to learn through your research so much more about these girls and get that written down and get it shared with others. It's just a special thing, I think.
Well, I think samplers speak to my heart, because these girls, not every girl could be educated. Not every girl is allowed to go to school. Not every girl was afforded that, along with boys too, but more so the girls less than the boys. And it not necessarily that these girls were privileged. These girls were lucky to have parents that cared enough about them and would scrimp to save, in some instances, scrimp to get pennies to send their children to school. Laundresses. This one story that from the Oblate School of Sisters of Providence in Baltimore, one of the girls that went there, her mother was a laundress locally. And she didn't board at the school, but she walked to school every day. And she, her mother scraped pennies together to get her daughter to have an education. And very important anytime. Girls' history, very little is written about it. A sampler is a tangible thing, proof of someone's importance of her education.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's important to me to regard these girls, give them respect. It's not just schoolwork. They're works of art as far as I'm concerned. And I just, oh, have my heart on my sleeve sometimes when I think about them. Because I have such respect for them. Yeah. And from the simplest marking sampler to the highly skilled lace work, open work, three-dimensional raised embroidery, just the work that is involved is just phenomenal. And it is art. It's not just, I don't consider it folk art because the girls, a folk art is some, the artist is someone who was not trained. Whereas these girls were trained. They went to school for this, and the parents paid extra for them to learn how to do embroidery at these schools. A girl that went to a boarding school, let's say, for example, it cost a couple $100 for the whole year for her to go, including the boarding and her food and her books and her other materials she needed. Now, on top of that, her parents probably had to spend another $200 just for the silks, for the linens, and the extra training just to learn how to do all those different types of embroidery. So that was on top of all the other things that she had to do.
So a huge financial commitment in a culture that really was male oriented.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yes.
So that really speaks to the parents as a couple and their commitment to their daughters, I mean, to their kids in general, but that's that's a strong statement for that, just in that regard, yeah. When did you start collecting samplers?
I started collecting them about the time I started making a list with Gloria about Maryland samplers.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know, because... they were popping up and I was becoming more aware of them and the different schools. And there was a local Annapolis antique dealer, and he put on all of his samplers that they were all American, and they were not. But there was one in particular I would go and look at. I just fell in love with her, and I would take my friend Deborah at the time, and anytime we were out and about doing something, I'd always have to stop at the antique shop to look at this one sampler. And she got tired of this, and she told my husband, "You need to buy this for her because I'm tired of going to see this sampler." So that was the first sampler that my husband bought me. And it turned out to be, she was from England. She was not from Bucks County, like this antique dealer said, because all you had to do is turn over the back side, and it said exactly where the sampler was framed, which was in, I wanted to say Portsmouth or Southampton, England. And then, of course, when I took it apart, it was definitely worked on an English wool fabric. It was not. And it had a little... dark green mark along the selvage, which was a tax line that came from England, and that's how you could also tell that that was made, that fabric was made in England. It's a rarity to find English linen that was brought over here, and then the girls girl made her sampler here. We've found maybe two or three that I know of that way. Normally, on average, that doesn't happen. So I can't say it never happens, because it could happen more often, but not actually. So yeah. That's a giveaway on how to figure out some of the antiques. But
now we've talked to several sampler people, and I mean, you guys have all gotten me, you've just sucked me right into this thing, so it's all of your fault. You know, I used to blame it on Nicola, but anymore, it's just all of you guys. It's just your fault.
I'm happy to enable.
Yeah,
I
well,
am, and I.
All of you are. So just, but you have, because you have a lot of in your collection and in your reproductions, American samplers, and then you have some Mexican. I mean, you have an interesting mix. But I'm curious, are there characteristics of American samplers that make them different from European, or are they just variations on the same theme, or what? How does that work? There must be some differences.
Well, some of the differences are what is the type of depends on the school, depends on the religious content sometimes. Most samplers will have some kind of religious content because the schools were that they were attending were religious, whether it be a Catholic convent, a Quaker boarding school, or a Dutch Lutheran school, Baptist school. It just depends on also who is trading with who, what countries are trading. You'll find on my one sampler from Colombia, South America, it looks very French, and that's because there were French nuns teaching her in Medellin, Colombia. And they were also doing trade with Germany. So you've got influence of several different countries. And when I say trade, I'm talking, there were magazines being printed in different countries. So those were being traded back and forth. There were books being printed in different countries. And if you're trading with those countries, just like you see, for perfect example, you take a Scottish sampler that has illuminated letters. And what I tell you, they might have little curlicues, little circles around the letters and all the different corners. Mm-hmm. You will also find that probably originated from the Netherlands, because you see that a lot in the northern. I'm working on one now that, oh my God, there's so many different so many alphabets on this, and they're all illuminated letters like that, different types.
Mm-hmm.
Now you see that also in America. I have one sampler, Mary Whitaker. I know she's from New England, and she's got all these different alphabets, the illuminated letters, and yet I couldn't tell you if she was Dutch or English or Scottish. She could have been a little bit of each, but you follow all those alphabets and how they move from, let's say, okay, the Netherlands to Scotland. Now they've come over to America, and they start in New England, and they keep moving across into New York and into up Canada. It's amazing to watch how a motif travels and moves around, and how they each one influences each other. Same with Mexican samplers. Certain things on Mexican samplers, I'm talking after Columbus came, they were doing a lot of trading with Germany. So you'll see a lot of German influence on their motifs. Trade has a lot to do with it. It does.
So in these days of a global economy that we talk about, we really really aren't any different than they were back then. It's just how fast we do it.
And to be honest, one of the things that moved trade a lot was embroidery, was silk, was the trade of clothing and fabric and that kind of thing. That's one of the number one things people wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at least the women did, for sure. And so that makes a big impact, early on.
Yeah. So you start collecting these samplers, you're hooked on them, and stitching, and then at some point you just say, wait a minute, I want to start reproducing, or was that kind of your plan?
Well, no. I had I had wanted to start reproducing, and I did start reproducing one sampler from Annapolis in 1997, but I hurt my arm, and I got it reproduced. I got it, I hurt my arm, and I had to quit stitching, no kidding, for 3 years. A lot of people that know me know this story. So I had to put Sarah Sands on hold, and I was moved out of the area for a couple years and came back to this area and got in contact with Gloria again and was helping her with finding out about more Maryland samplers. And it was actually Gloria that said, "Barb, when are you going to get going? You have to do this. We're going to have this exhibit. We're going to be doing this." So Gloria and a few other friends said, "Get out of the researching business and get going with your sampler business." So that's what I did. I started off in 2000. I started publishing in 2005. Because it's hard to put yourself out there, you know?
Yeah.
But I did. I thought, okay, you know, what's the worst that can happen, you know? And then it'll buy and it's okay.
Right.
I don't like them. But I started up with five samplers, a Mexican, an American, and I forget what else, a couple other little things. And they took off and they did okay. So they... And I put every time I make any money, it just goes back into buying more samplers or, you know, frames for the models or whatnot. And so it all goes, all returns to more samplers.
Just feed the meter.
Exactly. Exactly. It just goes right back into it.
So do you stitch all your models?
I used to.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I still do for the most part. I've got a terrific guy, John Kazmaier, award-winning sampler maker. He's more of a senior citizen, and he has a bucket list. So he only does about one for me a year. But he used to do a couple, at least two or three. He was doing for a while for me. So
that's a machine.
He is. Because not only would he do my models, but then he would redo the sampler to his liking. And he likes to work on very high count. He'll work on the 5260.
Ooh.
And he'll change the colors, and he'll just do what he – and they're gorgeous what he does. It just does a fabulous job. But when I first met John, he only did cross-stitch. And we finally got him to do so much more. We being the group, he belongs to a group of stitchers, and we help him along. But he was always on my case about, you know, getting my girls out faster. And I said, "Well, John, I can only stitch so far and so long. And, you know, do you want to do some for me?" And then I heard from him a month later, and he said, "Yes." Goodness. So John does that. My husband stitches, but he doesn't stitch my models. In fact, he hasn't really stitched at all in a little while. He does other things. Yeah. He has a lot of other hobbies. So.
Yeah, I suppose that in your house, yeah, eventually you'd feel pressured to at least try it. So.
Well, he does. He's completed two samplers,
uh-huh.
And on each one he says Jim's first sampler. He wrote it, and then the date, and then the second one he says Jim's second sampler. And so the third one he's working on. He's been working on it. It's got to be almost 10 years now, but he doesn't want to hear that, but he's going to hear it. And it's a blue Perman. It's got a bunch of sailboats on it because he likes boats. Being a sailor, he tend to like sailboats, but he just hasn't felt like picking it up in a while. So maybe I can get him to do it again. I don't know. He's got he's done a lot of other things. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for a lot of people, it comes and goes. You know, the interest. I mean, mm-hmm. For me, there were many years while we were raising kids where it went, but it was always in the corner in a bag somewhere, but. You know, kids Kids, yeah.
Well, and then I would, even if when I was working full time, I would try and have at least a half hour in the morning or to stitch, or after they went to sleep night, I'd get at least a good hour in or something. Because that was my therapy. That was what calmed me down. So I made a mistake. Then that wasn't such a calm part, period. But
yep.
So
you some of your reproductions, if I read things correctly, are ones that you own, but then you've also done reproductions from other people's collections. Do you just
yes? I have a couple friends that have collections. And they've allowed me to reproduce. I've also worked with museums, reproducing some of their samplers when they allow me to do that.
Yeah, how does that work? Do they actually let you take the thing with you?
Oh gosh, no. I go in. I bring my silks with me, and I bring my bring some fabric swatches. Get an idea. And sometimes I just use maybe some DMC cottons. I've got a bag of DMC cottons that are close to different fabric colors that I use on a regular basis from Lakeside Linens and from Zweigart Linens.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have those DMC colors with me, not just the fabric swatches. But so I'll take all this with me to the museum. I take a lot of photos. They'll allow me to take photographs. Most of the time, these pieces have been conserved at least to a mounting board, so I don't see the back side. Uh-huh. I only see the front side.
I wondered about that. I wondered if you get a look at the back. Yeah.
It just depends. Sometimes they do have them, but those aren't the ones that I have reproduced, that they've wanted me to reproduce. I work with the Maryland Historical Society, the Oblate Sisters of Providence in Maryland. There's a Winchester. Liddy Rhodes came from Virginia and Winchester. That I can't. It's a county historical society where she's from.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget. I know I'm missing a couple people. Oh yes, locally there's the my Queen Anne's County Historical Society wanted me to reproduce the sample that they have. But what was funny is sometimes you don't know what's on a sampler, even with the naked eye. I take these photographs and then I bring them home and I blow them up on my computer. So I have a laptop that I use for the photographs, and then my larger screen I use for charting. In this instance, and I'll blow up the photographs, and all of a sudden something turns up that wasn't there before.
Oh.
But that way, the naked eye didn't see this bird that was hiding in the clouds. Sometimes I find a name isn't what they think it was.
So
that's a surprise too.
Yeah.
Then we have to redo the complete history.
Right. I was going to say, yeah, that just made everybody do a left turn there. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I figured it out. So it's all right. Good in the end.
Yeah.
But
what is the motivation for museums? And if I'm asking questions that are none of my business, say so. But what is the motivation for them having you reproduce? I mean, does part of the sales go back to them, or do they just want it so that they can share it with others?
Twofold. Every time I work with a museum, they will always get a piece of the wholesale from me directly, or I will give them a larger royalty, or we can do it each time, or both. It depends on whatever they want. As long as if I can get permission, that's fine. Then they can sell the chart in their gift shop.
Mm.
And they'll make, you know, money on top of that. Usually when I'm allowed to do this, or I've asked permission, it's in conjunction with a sampler exhibit that they're having. And so people are coming in and they're looking for it. Hopefully they'll put these on their websites so that people can all around the world can find it. However, with some of these smaller county historical society, you've constantly got changing personnel. Mm-hmm. And so the website is not always up to date, and these things are not always, you know, there. But and they're small. They're small little places, but we do what we can. I'm working with another county to help just south of me in Eastern Maryland, Talbot County. We're trying to get their samplers conserved, and I've worked with them to help them learn more about their samplers, and I've given a couple of lectures there, and we're drumming up some money to help them to get their samplers conserved. I've got a couple guilds I belong to, and we're just waiting to hear from the conservators as how much of it is. And one of the things my guilds do is help pay for that kind of thing.
Okay.
So if there's a most of the guilds work on a nonprofit, and when we have too much money in our accounts, we need to spend it mm-hmm. on something like that. So we try to find these smaller people that need, and even some of the big museums need help, you know, with the conservation of their samplers. So yeah. We're there to help. And they're good groups.
What goes into that? What goes into conservation? You're going to say it depends, but is it generally just a cleaning or repair, or is it just getting it off of whatever it's mounted on because it's destroyed? Right. The mounting is destroying it. What generally do you run into?
Well, repair is not what we do anymore. Right. It's not a matter of repairing. It's a matter of preserving. You don't want to change what is there. You just want to make sure it doesn't get any worse. You want to get it as clean as possible. And you don't want to hurt it in any way. The conservators would a lot of times. So it depends on how the condition, and you don't want any glass touching it. You don't want any wood touching it, or paper, or cardboard. You want conservation. You want archival, museum quality, everything. Mm-hmm. You don't want anything that is going to hurt that. My girls, I've got two that are conserved and framed. Most of my antiques are archival boxes. Some of them are mounted on archival mounting boards. And I have layers of bleached linen, or a little bit heavier than that, not muslin, heavier than muslin, not linen, in between them. I don't have too many on top of each other either. And I change out the linen. I don't use the archival paper so much. I do use some of it, but you have to change that out every year. So it's, for me, it's easier to just clean the, wash the fabric that I put, the unbleached fabric that I put between them to keep them out.
Okay, wait, back up the truck here a little bit. So acid-free tissue paper, you should change that out every year?
Yes, you should.
Oh.
If you've got your wedding, not your personal wedding dress, if someone has a wedding dress.
Can't help you there,
stuff,
no.
Yeah, if they've got, if you're using archival paper, you need to change that every year.
Oh.
Because it loses its good quality.
Oh.
It's only good for so long. So the other thing is, let's see, I've got all my girls in archival boxes that aren't framed, laying flat. I wanted to buy a metal map chest that I could put them in, but I just don't have room in my house for it. I could move out one of the rooms and take over another room, but no, at this time I just don't have that. And it's hard to give my little girl, my girls up, but I know I'm going to have to probably sell some just to keep going, the business going.
Yeah.
But it is hard to part with them, you know. They're part of the family.
Yeah, sure. That's something that there just seems to be, the more I've been exposed to these samplers, there seems to be an endless supply of these things. Is that the case? I mean, are they constantly being discovered, or are they just getting moved around enough that it seems like there's a lot of them?
Well, they do get moved around. No doubt about it. They go from collection to collection. But more and more are being discovered all the time. I don't think we're ever going to see them all. People don't know what they have. Don't even, you know, a lot of times they're found in furniture rolled up in a drawer that no one knows about. Those are the really good ones to find that haven't seen the light of day in a long time. But, you know, you find them all over the place. I find them in antique shops and on auctions. I find them online auctions, not necessarily just eBay, but, you know, auction houses like Sotheby's and a few others. Serious collectors, you need to know who Amy Finkel is of samplings.com.
Yes.
The Hubers, too, have some. And Ruth Van Tassel's in just side of Chester County. She's in Chester County. She has some nice samplers, too. A few other people, very good sampler people. But you got to be where, you know, you've got to know what you're doing and what to look for, too, if you're going to be, you know, going on into the auction houses and looking.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read enough to have a sense that you can really get taken if you're not wary and you don't know what you're doing, that you can end up with something that's relatively worthless and pay a lot for it.
Even those of us who have had some experience have been taken too. A photograph, if you're not sure, ask for more photographs if it's something online. And if they're not willing to give you more photographs, then, you know, don't deal with them.
Walk away.
Walk away because, it's always buyer beware. And it's better to be safe than sorry.
So do we have, in your area, it sounds like we have a community of collectors, and when something interesting goes up, the word spreads like wildfire?
It does. And I do monitor eBay. I monitor a lot of the online auctions because I'm looking for samplers, not just to buy, because I really don't, I've cut back quite a bit on what I was buying, but unless something really cool comes along. but for the most part, I still look daily, and it's for research purposes mostly.
Uh-huh.
And there are a lot of people that I'm looking for certain things when I see them. And other people I know are looking for certain types of samplers, and I'll let them know if something comes up. In other words, I like to spend other people's money. and there are times I also look at estate sales throughout the country.
Uh-huh.
I've been able to find a couple of important samplers that way. And if I can't physically go to one of these estate sales, I hopefully know someone in the area that will go and buy it for their collection. If they don't want to buy it for their collection, I'll buy it from them. It doesn't happen too often. They usually keep it. Because I've been able to find some pretty good deals for some people. Some very important samplers have been found that way.
Yeah.
Another good reason to keep abreast on some of these auctions is one time I was able to help a museum find a lost sampler.
Oh.
That made me feel really proud.
Yeah.
One that had been missing from their collection for a long time. So we were able to reconnect that with that museum.
Oh, that's great.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, that made my day.
So what, and we got, darn it, we got to wrap up. I hate this.
Okay.
No, we're not going to right now. What is it that makes you just jump up and buy a sampler? Is there something special about them that if one shows up, you can't resist it? Or does each one either have to speak to you or not speak to you?
They usually have to tell a story for me.
Okay.
It either has to have some kind of if it's from a special school, last summer I found one that I thought was Delaware, but it's actually Maryland, but it's the teacher that moved back and forth from Delaware and Maryland. And that was the teacher was Mrs. Ann Barclay Cloud. And the sampler I bought has, it's beautifully freestyle embroidery with some sheep and some lots of flowers. It's in the fruit and flower group. So I had to have that one. I just had to.
Okay.
Susanna Spiro just came out this year, and she tells a fabulous story of a village. There's different houses. There's a milkmaid. There's some happy cows. It just spoke to me, and I had to have it. There's another designer that collects cows, and I've put cow samplers onto her. Well, I've told her about them, but this one had to come home to me because it was just it was just so special. I had to have it. So, you know, it has to speak to me some way, and I like a lot of the simple ones too. A very simple Quaker sampler by Sarah Comfort is so endearing. It's all one color. It has a couple of alphabets, her name, her parents, and her brothers and sisters. That's mm-hmm. all. Uh-huh. And that's all it really has to say. So that's a very sweet sampler too.
Okay, one last question. We got to go. What's the one sampler in your collection you'd never part with?
Oh, that's pretty easy. That's Mary Reese, 1785.
Mary Reese?
Mary Reese. R-E-E-S-E. And she's similar to a lot of she wasn't in Ann Marsh's school, but someone from Ann Marsh School of Philadelphia taught her. And Ann Marsh's mother was Elizabeth Marsh. They came over in the 1720s to Philadelphia. And I think some of the most spectacular samplers came from that school. So I'm thrilled to have that one in my collection. Absolutely thrilled.
Did you reproduce it?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
She came down from a family of four samplers.
Okay. I'm scrambling through your site right now to see if I can find it.
Yeah. Mary Reese, and then also, well, Sarah Comfort and the Elizabeth Borton and Lydia Borton, all four of those samplers were descended into the same family.
Oh, Mary Reese. Oh, I just found it. Holy smokes.
Isn't she fabulous?
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah.
Very special. Very special piece.
Wow. So, that bottom band there with the.
Exactly. And that bottom band's been around since the 1520s.
Yeah.
It's one of the first bands that was published and printed in, I forget, either Denmark or Germany. I forget which. But yeah, 1520s is when that came out. So it's very similar to another fabulous Quaker sampler. So this one's Quaker too. The Dorcas Haynes, which is in the Fitzwilliams. One of these days I'm going to stitch that one. I have the chart. I have the silks. It's all ready to go. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I got to get the Mary Reese one. Wow, that's nice. Oh, my. Yeah, I can see. I can see why you wouldn't let that go. I assume the original's in really good shape.
No, she's not, actually. Oh. And I have to tell you that this Mary Reese is an adaptation because all the writing that was on the original was missing.
Oh.
So I put in prose that I thought was some of the text is from other samplers from the same school. All right.
Okay.
And some of it is a lot of it is Quaker thoughts. Let's put it that way.
Uh-huh.
And it, it all works together well. So I have to call it an adaptation because I couldn't figure out what it said.
Yeah.
So sorry about that.
So all of the text was gone, but everything else was intact enough that you could reproduce it.
Right. The only thing that was still there was her name, because the text had been stitched in a silk that was dyed with a walnut, or and it just deteriorated. Uh-huh. It just fell apart.
Oh.
So.
The things you guys get to learn doing these. Wow. So much fun.
Okay. Well, it's been a lot of fun talking to you, and we should talk again.
Oh, we will.
Okay.
All right, Barbara, thanks so much. And thanks to everyone for listening. And I hope Christine and I will be back on Wednesday. We're sure going to try.